Welcome back to the WRN podcast, and today we have a fabulous guest, Gillian Philip. Welcome.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much for having me. It's great to be here.
First, where in the world are you? And have you added any more new animals?
I am in the northeast of Scotland, up Murray, by the Murray Firth. It's a beautiful sunny day in the countryside. I can barely remember which animals I have last noted that I added, but the current total stands at 2 cats, 4 chickens, although I haven't seen 2 of them since they went broody, and 3 tiny horses who are eating me out of house and home. And I was going to go and get fish, but it's a bit late in the year for that, so they'll have to wait till the spring.
How lovely. How lovely. Up in Scotland with the animals.
I really want some baby goats, but I've really got to control myself.
They eat everything.
Do they? All right.
Well, jump over everything. Are escape artists. Ghosts? I've been reading your stories. Goats. You are currently doing a completely different job, which we will come to. But previously, you were working as a children's author. What inspired you to do that?
I'd always wanted to be a writer. Mm-hmm. Since I was very little, I used to just write my own stories about my cats. And I would write my own stories about the man from Uncle and Silver Brumby, and mix them up. And the man from Uncle went with the Silver Brumby on adventures. You can tell my age from these, by the way. And I just always really enjoyed it. And it took me a while to I started writing short stories for women's magazines, which I really enjoyed. I'd gone to, my husband and I had moved to Barbados for his work in the very late 80s. And I couldn't work. I didn't have a work permit. So that's when I really started seriously doing the short stories. But I never did novels until like the beginning of the 2000s. When I'd had my kids, I just suddenly thought, I don't know why I thought this is a great time to start writing novels, because like I had 2 small children. I did just start in spare moments, and I suddenly had these characters in my head. I really wanted, I just felt I had to get them down the page. They were bugging me. So I just started to write, and I would write a paragraph here, a page there, and it all started to come together. So I sort of really started properly writing in 2003, was published in 2010. So it, as with so many people, it took a while, but I loved writing what I was writing. Because I'd had kids, I kind of gravitated toward children's writing. Uh-huh. I found I loved it. I found I was quite good at it. So I just kept writing.
And did you do any writing courses, or did you read up on anything, or did this just flow from you?
I didn't do any courses. I just kind of sat down and did it by instinct. I would send, when I had a completed manuscript, I used to send them to editorial services, which I can recommend to anybody. to be honest, I wouldn't honestly recommend creative writing courses to, I'm sure they work for some people, but I just don't think they're necessary. I think if you've got stories in your head and you've got the latent talent, you'll kind of know how to do it without that. And yes, you'll get things wrong, but that's what editorial services are for. And I learned a lot from those editorial services. I learned how to structure better. I learned how to plot better and pull it together more concisely. And that really worked for me. So I wrote several young adult novels. It went well.
It certainly did. Your fantasy series, Rebel Angels, written for teenagers. You described that as a Scottish historical to urban fantasy. What's that mean? And are you proud of? I think this is one of the nicest things somebody could possibly say about somebody's writing. This is a review of one of the books, that your prose is as fiery as whiskey.
Oh,
that.
Just reminded me of that, and I remember that now. It was a lovely review, lovely quote. Do you know, the Rebel Angels series was what I started with when I started out in 2003. These were the characters I couldn't get out of my head. These are the ones I really needed to write down, and the whole kind of, and I did want to write something based on Scottish mythology. It was something I grew up with. It was something I really loved to read. So I wanted it based on that, but I didn't want to do, I didn't want it to be just a traditional fairy story, so to speak. So I wanted to sort of start in history and bring it forward and update it to the present time. So I had to have these really long-lived characters, basically, who would take me from like the 16th century to the 21st century. And I had to kind of work out how to do that and make it kind of believable within the world. And that's where the kind of urban fantasy to Scottish historical thing comes in. I had such fun with those characters, and I am still, I mean, that, although I started that one in 2003, that was the first book in that series, Firebrand, wasn't published till 2010. Mm-hmm. And I got that date slightly wrong, because in the meantime, I wasn't getting the books right. You know, I just wasn't getting them right. So I started writing other books, and I wrote a book called Bad Faith, which was a kind of dystopian novel set in Scotland, a kind of alternative Scotland. That was the first novel I got published, which was 2008, in fact. And then a book called Crossing the Line, which was about knife crime, which was 2009. And The Opposite of Amber, 2011, I think.
Mm-hmm.
So actually, the first Rebel Angels book wasn't ready for publication until about 2010. It needed a lot of work. And, you know, I suspect a lot of writers are like this. I can't read them now.
Mm.
They're never right. They're never right. And I mean, people tell me they love them, and that makes me really, really happy. I'm still incredibly fond of the characters, but I cannot bring myself to read them, because I just know I would have, you know, things would have changed. I could have made them better. I would have done things differently. I can't ever face rereading them.
If there's anybody out there who would like to help bring these books to screen, I think that might that might help Gillian reread them and perhaps want to do the screen.
I can fix everything.
The Class of the Titans series also looks great, again, you've got this kind of mythology, historical stuff going on, and that was aimed at Key Stage 3. Tell us about that.
That was so much fun. That was for Oxford University Press, and I had so much fun writing those. I've always been really into mythology, as you can tell. I started when I was very little with the Greek myths, which my dad used to read to me. And I loved Greek mythology. I had never written about it, and Oxford University Press asked me for a series. It was actually four different stages. The concept was that you started with a simple book, and then it gradually increased in kind of sophistication and complexity to the fourth book. So it was supposed to kind of run over basically four key stages, starting, I think, with Key Stage 3. So the first book was quite basic, and then but it was all the same story. So it had the same story arc. Which was challenging and very much fun. And I loved kind of taking the Greek myths and just turning them into something that was slightly different without losing sort of some of the essential character. But obviously for that age, you can't have, the gods swallowing their children and things like that. It's really, it's not going to
work. I think kids love all that, though. Do you not think they like the gory?
It's probably the schools, which, and it was kind of aimed at schools, probably weren't going to want
okay.
that. So I lightened it a lot. But I had such fun with it. You know, Kronos and Zeus and Hera and all the old, Artemis and Apollo. And I had so much fun just with all those characters. I really did. They were so much fun. yeah, if I die and like the Greek gods turn out to have been the real ones, I'll be in a lot of trouble.
I think we all will. Yeah, I think we all will. Where does Erin Hunter come into all of this?
So I was invited to submit for the Erin Hunter series in, I think, round about 2010, 2011. I knew one of the editors there just socially, having met her on Facebook and at a few events. And she had suggested that I would be a good fit. They were starting a new series. They'd been very successful with a series called Warrior Cats, particularly in the United States,
okay.
which is a key element of the story, as it turns out later. It was hugely successful in the States. They wanted to branch out into a series about dogs. And this editor thought I would be a good fit for that series. So I was invited to submit, and I was chosen to join the team. So I started to write this series called Survivors, which was about dogs existing without their human owners after an earthquake in the Pacific Northwest. I turned out to be good at it. I wrote half, there were 2 6-book arcs in Survivors and a few kind of novellas. I wrote about half of those books altogether. I toured the States to promote it. And those tours went really well. It turned out I was quite good at presenting and public speaking as well. So they were really pleased with my work. And when they came to write to develop a series about African animals called Bravelands, they wanted me to do that as well. And as it turned out, I ended up being the exclusive writer on those until I was fired. Now, the thing you have to, the thing that's quite sometimes difficult to explain about the Erin Hunter books is that, like, I am not the author of those books, in that I have nothing to do with plot development or storyline or anything like that. There's a sort of committee at Working Partners, who are the company who produced them, who kind of work out what the story is going to be. What they think is going to work, and they do an extremely detailed storyline. They invent the characters. It's all incredibly detailed, right down to things like speech tags, the behavior of the animals, the names of the animals, and the animals' language, which can be quite convoluted. So they do all of that, then they give you the storyline and say, write that. To the length of 60,000 words. And that's how it works. And there's a lot of writers writing on all these series. So when it came to Bravelands anyway, yeah, I started out as sort of supposed to be doing half the books again. As it turned out, the other writer, it didn't work out, let's put it that way. So I ended up doing all the Bravelands series until I was fired. So that's kind of how Erin Hunter works. That's how I got involved with it. And although I wasn't creating the stories, I wasn't creating the characters, anything like that, it was very much just kind of, it was like copywriting, bit of a hack job, if I'm honest. You know, it's just like you're just writing for the money. But I was really good at it. I was really good at it. And I'm not shy about saying that, because particularly when I was really used to it and I got to the Bravelands books, when I was very familiar with African wildlife, I was just doing a really good job. So yeah, they were incredibly pleased with it.
And so they should have been. So they should have been. And you know, by this point, you have a not insignificant number of books to your name and stories to your name, and doing really well. I'm just thinking of the timeline. Am I right in thinking your most recent was Clickbait?
That's right. That was, Well, besides the Erin Hunter books, my most recent of my own was Clickbait. I genuinely have to look inside it to find the exact year. Maybe 2019, something like that. So something like that. So Clickbait was my last book written and authored by me, under my own, created by me. That was published by a company called Black Dog, who are a very good publishing company. They, because they don't care what your personal views are. They just care what your writing's like.
I've heard very good things about Clickbait as well by a number of the women in WRN. And actually, just for our listeners, do you want to give a quick synopsis of what that one's about?
Sure, it's about this lad called Eddie Doolin, who he makes a joke, and there's been a local tragedy. And he finds this 9/11 joke that he's had a few beers. He thinks it's hilarious, as, you know, young boys often think black humour is hilarious. Mm-hmm. Black humour is very hilarious. But Eddie says, that's incredibly funny. I can adapt that to fit the local situation. So he adapts this joke, posts it on social media, kind of goes to sleep half drunk, and wakes up to, can I say this word, a shitstorm?
Yes, you can.
He wakes up to a shitstorm that gradually snowballs. And essentially, Eddie has just destroyed his own life, basically, for a joke. He gets fired. He kind of, he loses all his mates. He's only got two pals, one of whom is Sid, who's the sort of the local gamekeeper's daughter, this kid who always comes to him from next door for bacon sandwiches, because he's kind of little lost kid. So he's got these two mates, and he's got this beautiful girlfriend who now can't have anything to do with him. So, and it's just all about how Eddie has to try and rebuild his life, and how it's made very hard for him, and he has to have an awful lot of goes at rebuilding his life, and it's, I'm not going to tell you how it ends,
no, don't,
but happily or unhappily, but I'm very fond of Eddie. It's funny, I'll say that word again. He's a shit, but you know, he's my shit. He's like, I just love him. I love him with all his flaws and all his faults. And I think I am better at writing male characters, which is funny. I do enjoy writing male characters because I like trying to think myself into that male mindset, and I think I do a not bad job. This does not mean I could be a man, however. It's just the empathetic exercise of trying to think yourself into someone else's head, and I just particularly enjoy trying to understand men, especially young men. I've done it with Eddie, I've done it with Nick in Crossing the Line, I've done it with Seth in the Rebel Angel series, and it's always huge fun. You think, how do these guys think this way? It's like, okay, let's take that back and like, let's find out why they think that way. And I just find it enormously enjoyable, it's one of the things that I think is being lost. I mean, I don't think a mainstream publisher would object to a woman writing male characters at the moment. But there's a lot of characters who they would object to you writing if you are not from the exact same socioeconomic cultural, racial class as that character. And I think that's, you know, you have to have sensitivity in writing, and that's what editors, a good editor, should be there to do. And you should have the sensitivity and intelligence yourself to be careful writing someone who doesn't come from, you know, the exact same background as you do. But I think it's killing imagination and killing the whole point of writing to say you can only write as someone who is exactly like you. I really do believe that. I think it's a phase. I think it'll end eventually, but I think at the moment it's killing imaginative writing.
It kills creativity, full stop, doesn't it? The whole of the arts, same in acting. Those who say, well, straight men shouldn't be playing gay men, and
it's called acting.
Quite. And if you are an author of fiction, then you are bringing those characters to life, but they are in your head.
Yes.
And if you are a skilled author and you have that creativity and that empathy, and a good editor, mm-hmm. then yes, you should be able to write about anyone, including also at any time. None of us lived in the 16th century.
Not quite.
You're not meant to write an historical novel.
Exactly. I mean, we don't. We may read up about the witch hunts, which Firebrand covers, but we can't know what it was like to be, you're this kind of woman with a cat and some great herbal skills. You don't know what, you know, exactly what it was like for her. You have to imagine it. You have to imagine yourself into the situation. You have to kind of try to empathize with someone who lived 500 years ago, for God's sake, you know? And that's a good thing.
It is. It is.
If we can't try to understand what people thought and were like in the past, yes, all we can do is imagine. But if we don't even try to do that, what are we doing?
It's a creativity cul-de-sac. It completely is.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Talking of witches, one day you typed into your Twitter bio, # I stand with J.K. Rowling.
I did.
What made you do that, Jill?
It's actually quite, there was quite a bit that led up to this, right? So I started becoming aware of the gender debate in about, I would say, I can trace it back to about 2017. I remember being very shocked about the Mariah McLachlan thing in Hyde Park.
Yeah.
And the subsequent court case in which she was chided for, and you can't see me doing quote marks, but I'm doing them, misgendering the man who attacked her, who assaulted her. And I'd been vaguely uneasy up till then, but that kind of crystallized in my mind, no, there's something deeply wrong here. And I did start talking about it. I started tweeting about it publicly. So I did that on and off right up until 2020. There was a point at which my agent said, is this a good idea? She sent me this email I was not sure this is a good idea. We're going to want to launch your next book, blah, 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 blah. She didn't mention Erin Hunter, Working Partners, or any of that. It was all about my next book under my own name. So I kind of thought, oh, damn it, I better do it. So I went off and I created a new anonymous account called Cat Spraddled. I'll tweet my political opinions under that, and I'll keep my main account, which was under my own name, for work. Nah.
Yeah.
So I started, I did start tweeting anonymously as Cat Spraddled. And that went on until roughly late in, I think that was probably about a year I started 2018, tweeting as Cat Spraddled. Late 2019, J.K. Rowling, I think her famous tweet was in December 2019, wasn't it? But it was either slightly before then or slightly afterwards. It was actually the case of Rachel Rooney that got me very exercised about this. Now, I should say that I have been tweeting since, I think, 2011 or something, and, oh, man, I was opinionated. I've always been horrifically opinionated. I would tweet about anything. You know, I tweeted about the Scottish referendum. I tweeted about the Euro referendum. I tweeted about the Corbyn years in Labour. I tweeted about the Tories. I tweeted about, you know, I was so opinionated. So it wasn't anything my publishers and agent didn't know.
Yeah.
This was the first issue, genderism, that I'd been actively warned about. So anyway, but it came to the point in late 2019, early 2020, when I discovered the story of Rachel Rooney. Now, if anyone doesn't know that story, she had written a book called My Body Is Me. It's a picture book. So it's basically 200 and something words long with beautiful illustrations. And it's a book celebrating every child's body and saying, you know, my body is me, you know, it's the only one I've got. I have to look after it and cherish it. And that's what you are your body. Now, there was a certain clique, and I knew just how much transgenderism had taken hold in publishing. I knew it had a very strong hold in publishing houses, among writers and writers' organisations. I knew that, but I had never seen it take such horrific, abusive form as I did in the case of Rachel Rooney. Because when this book was published, she was instantly shredded, vilified, torn apart by a clique, not of anonymous trolls on Twitter. She was vilified by a nasty, mean girl clique of children's authors, including some fairly well-known ones. We're talking Claire Vulliemi, Robin Stevens, David Stevens, now named D, apparently. We're talking Joe Cottrell. There's, you know, and they kind of came together and destroyed her to the extent that she felt she could no longer write. She could not be in the publishing industry. She could not work as a writer. She couldn't bear it. So she said, that's it. I've got a few more books in the pipeline that are in the process of being published, but I am done with the publishing industry. Rachel's autistic. She works with autistic children as well. She's not neurotypical, unlike her incredibly middle-class, incredibly privileged abusers, basically. And she was run out of the publishing industry. And it horrified me to the point where I did actually tweet about it on my own personal writer account as Gillian Phillip. And I basically told everyone what I thought of them, and said, look, you're all a disgrace, sort of thing. I am only tweeting about work in this account. If you want to find out my political opinions, I've got this other account. It's called Cat Spraddled. You can see what I think there. And then, just not long after that, a month or two after that, it's very hard to remember the exact timescale, but J.K. Rowling was getting monstered on Twitter again for another tweet. So I went back to my writer account and I said, look, I said again, here's my political opinion tweets. They're on Cat Spraddled, but I am putting the hashtag on my bio. I stand with J.K. Rowling because I do. And it was very quiet for 2 or 3 weeks, I think. Nothing really happened. I was kind of waiting for a grenade to go off in some senses, but I woke up one morning, it was the 25th of June, 2020. And there were a couple of abusive messages. They weren't messages because I don't accept DMs from people I don't know. So they were on my Twitter. A couple of abusive messages. And a sort of slight cold chill went down my spine because I thought, this looks different. So I blocked them, deleted them, ignored them. And then they kept coming for 24 hours. Mm. And they kind of snowballed. A bit like what happened to Eddie in Clickbait. It kind of snowballed over 24 hours. And the more people who tweeted at me, the more joined in. Now, there were supportive messages coming in. And if I didn't acknowledge or reply to any of those, I just want to apologize to those people now and say I'm sorry because I didn't see it. Because I know there were some coming in. But it was an absolute avalanche of abuse. There were rape threats. There were death threats. They were inventing extraordinary ways that I could die. You know, abusive, sexualized tweets. And at one, I mean, there's several points. I got that notice saying, you know, your rate limits exceeded. There were so many abusive messages coming in. I got snippy a couple of times with a couple of them. I tried to ignore them, but sometimes they got too abusive and I would like snap something back. I never swore at them, never abused them or anything. And eventually I locked down my account. You'll see accusations on Twitter, by the way, that I doxed a minor. I did not dox a minor. What happened was somebody sent me an incredibly abusive message via my website. I screenshotted it, I posted it on Twitter, and that person instantly cried victim. That I can do it to you, but don't so much as complain when I send you abusive messages, because that, you know, that makes you. There was an email address on it that was a fake one anyway. And if that person was a minor, they knew some language that minors really knowing. So it went on 24 hours. Anyway, I got to sleep about 5 o'clock the next morning. I woke up at 9 o'clock in the morning with my agent on the phone. La la la, we've got to see what working partners think of this. And then working partners were on the phone and they had to say, oh, we've got to see what HarperCollins think of this, because HarperCollins was working partners' customer. They were the ones who published their 100 books in the United States. The HarperCollins office opened at 2 p.m., which was 9 a.m. New York time, 2 p.m. our time. And like at 2:01 p.m. our time, I was fired. Oof. They didn't ask for my side of the story. They didn't ask what had happened. They didn't ask what had provoked this. They didn't even ask how I was feeling, frankly. They simply fired me. So HarperCollins ordered working partners to fire me. Working partners fired me. And within the next 24 hours, my agent had also dropped me, not only as an Erin Hunter, but as an independent author of my own books. So just within 24 hours, there'd been the blood in the water of the JK Rowling hashtag. And 24 hours later, I was fired. It was that quick.
Wow.
It was that brutal. And the hilarious thing was, and I say hilarious when it isn't. This is one of those dark humor things that we were talking about. Working partners, 5 weeks earlier, had sent me a beautiful bouquet of flowers, expressing their sympathy and support. Because my husband had just died. And they knew it. They sent me a bouquet to sympathize. And 5 weeks later, they fired me on the word and the orders of an anonymous horde on Twitter.
Holy.
My work for them counted for nothing. My much of it unpaid, like the tours in America. My support for this brand, my loyalty to the company. I mean, I had basically become an exclusively a writer for the brand because the deadlines were so tight and the demands were so high. It had been a long time since I'd actually managed to write a full book of my own. So my loyalty was to this brand and it was my main income. I mean, it was more than 99% of my income. It felt a little bruising, to say the least, that none of that counted for anything, that they would simply cave to an anonymous Twitter hoard. HarperCollins, gigantic company, working partners, part of Kulabi, which is also a huge company, and my agent, part of a very successful agency partnership, caved to anonymous, abusive trolls. It's extraordinary when you think about it.
It is. It's flabbergasting. And sadly, you're not the only person this has happened to, but at the time when that must be happening to you, it must feel very... Did it feel isolating? Did you think, how... Why me? How the hell has this happened? What do I do now?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yes. I was in a state. I on Twitter, on social media publicly, I was brazening out like mad. Because you don't want these people to see that they've got to you. Mm. You want to give them the satisfaction. However, they do. I mean, it is a horrible experience. And as you say, very isolating. I mean, a couple of friends in the author community sent me messages, but very, very keen to say, you know, to sort of at the same time distance themselves. I think you've been treated awfully, but I don't agree with you at all. And one of them tried to post a supportive message on Facebook, was instantly piled on and instantly deleted it because these people are cowards. They can't even, you know, they can't even stand up for a friend. So it is incredibly isolating. However, it was lockdown year. As luck would have it, my children had got home before lockdown, and they were with me, and they were an unbelievable support, as were their partners. So I had my children, but they should not have had to support me, actually, in that way at that time. And I look back and I really regret it because I think they were having to sort of support me, actually literally hold me up on one occasion, my son, 5 weeks after their father died. It was my job to be looking after them, and they had to look after me, and that was not right. That was not right. And I will never forgive the people who caused that. And so I had my children there, but I didn't know actually who else I had. I have dear friends, neighbours down the road, who I would, you know, go and howl at the moon with. But the writing community, the publishing community, was of literally no use. But at the same time, almost immediately, as soon as I came back on Twitter, I deactivated my account and I came back on Twitter, and then people were contacting me. Not people from the writing community. People from, you know, people from the gender critical community, from the gender community, from the radical feminist community. I don't care, you know, I don't care what you want to call them, you know. But from that community, feminists, TERFs, as they call us, and as we have claimed for ourselves, they were getting in touch with me and saying, we're here for you, we've got your back. And it was absolutely extraordinary. I came back onto Twitter and I looked at my follower count and it had slumped. I had about 5,000 followers on the 25th June. And that had slumped by about 1,000 as, you know, people kind of dissociated from me. And over the next week or two, it absolutely shot up. And it was all these people who had my back and were there for me, strangers when my friends weren't. And now I have this amazing community behind me, and I stand with that community, and they stand with me, and we stand with everyone else this happens to. And it is the most extraordinary community I've ever found in my life. It's incredible. And we all have vastly, vastly different political opinions, but on this we stand together, and we don't judge each other for those other political opinions. I mean, it's actually been amazing. I've made, you know, the best friends of my life after this happened. And this is one of the reasons I would never regret actually doing what I did and adding that hashtag, because yes, my life changed vastly and it was catastrophic at the time, but my life is better now. It's more honest, it's more truthful, and I have better friends. My God. I mean, the women and the men in this movement are amazing. And I mean, it's hysterical because I was a unionist over the Scottish independence referendum, and now like I've got all these great mates who are nationalists, and they know I'm a unionist, and we're all like, yeah, better together. So it's been eye opening. It's been humbling. It's been it's taught me a lot about myself as well. You know, but what's important, you know, it's been absolutely incredible.
You have had a lot of support as you have headed into your tribunal, given that you were dropped like a stone in no time at all. How's that tribunal going?
Well, first of all, the important thing about the tribunal is that the first thing I want to just thank everyone who has contributed to my crowdfunder, who has shared my crowdfunder and promoted it, because it has been amazing. I mean, I do think that when we get together, we can do anything. And it's been absolutely jaw-dropping, the support I've had for that crowdfunder that enabled me to take Working Partners and HarperCollins to the Employment Tribunal. I mean, from the bottom of my heart, deepest thanks to everyone who's helped me. The tribunal, we got through a very difficult obstacle at the first tribunal, which was that I was out of time. Basically, I had been in such a state of my sacking. I couldn't organise things. I couldn't basically provide what my lawyers were looking for. I was also trying to find a way to earn money. I was trying to look for a job and retrain, and I simply didn't do anything in time. But we got over it. But the tribunal accepted that was extraordinary circumstances, and we overcame that obstacle. The obstacle we did not at that time overcome was the difference between a writer and an author, basically. So we are still fighting that. We had an employment appeal tribunal a couple of weeks ago, and we're just waiting for the result. Everything depends on whether I'm judged to have been an employee, essentially an employee in open name, or a contractor. And, you know, we say that's the difference between being a writer of something that wasn't mine, I had nothing to do with, I was simply a copywriter, or authoring something that I created myself. And that's basically what has to be decided now. So I'm just waiting for the result.
Okay. Do you know what the timeline is on when you'll hear?
I really don't.
Okay. Oh, okay. Fingers crossed. We'll be looking out for that one. And if that goes your way, what happens then?
I'm really not sure in that one. It would probably go back to the Employment Tribunal to be re-adjudicated, I believe, but I don't know.
These things get so complicated. Okay. You have already gone through a great deal, but then you are without income. As you said, the working partner stuff was what, 99% at the time?
Oh, getting on for it. Yeah, definitely. Yeah. I mean,
it's a significant amount.
In fact, 2020, it was 100%. I wasn't writing anything else.
So you need to live. You pivoted in a way that I think others might not have expected. What do you do for a living now?
Well, I retrained as an HGV driver.
Love it.
I got my class 2 license after a couple of false attempts. I passed my HGV license, one of the proudest days of my life. So happy. It was actually the friends I mentioned before who lived down the road. They'd suggested it. Said, you know, they're very good at brainstorming things. And they said, like, you like driving. How about that? Because they knew I didn't want to sit in an office. I would have gone and I wouldn't have been capable of it at that time. So you like driving. Why don't you train as an HGV driver and, like, drive our horses or whatever? And I was like, oh, never mind the horses. I could just retrain as an HGV driver, you know. So and they were like, yeah, go for it. So I did. Had 2 failures. The first test was a disaster. The second test, I was this close and a little bit. Car came out from a roundabout and I just knew immediately I'd failed because I'd pulled out in front of it. And the tester was kind of almost as frustrated as I was because, like, he was very happy up to then. But the third attempt, I finally passed my test. And
am I allowed to ask at what age you did that?
Well, I must have been 57 when I passed that test. 59.
Never too late. Never too late.
But you know what? It's what a difference it is. But what fun it is. I mean, I've worked for an agency, so I've had lots of different HGV jobs, as well as other driving jobs. It's not just HGVs. So, you know, I've worked for loads of different companies transporting loads of different. Different goods. I mean, 5 fridges to Loch Inver, which was hilarious. A Loch Inver pie shop, a famous Loch Inver pie shop. And
that sounds like the start of some sort of travel book.
Or a children's picture book, because the parking, I was slightly on a slope and I couldn't get these fridges off this HGV. It literally was physically impossible. And by the time we got the entire staff of the restaurant, the chef, the manager, the harbour master, the coast guard, I mean, practically everybody in the village, it was like the enormous turnout.
I was thinking that as you said it, yes.
And it was hilarious. And I'm just, you know, and I've worked for tenants delivering kegs of beer. I've had so many great experiences and it's been so much fun. At the moment, I'm driving a van for a wonderful company, pretty much full time. I've been less in an HGV lately. I'm not even going to name the company, obviously, for reasons. Mm-hmm. They are wonderful and they're wonderful bosses. So, So I've been driving their van for a bit. So, yeah.
What do you do whilst you're driving? Do you listen to podcasts? Do you listen to the radio? What sort of music do you listen to? That sort of thing.
I listen to music. I listen to mostly country music. I'm an awful country addict.
That suits being in a big lorry.
Right, exactly. You know, it's like the convoy. I do listen to podcasts sometimes. I listen to audiobooks. Mm. I've got a lot of audiobooks, which is brilliant.
I can highly recommend the latest Strike novel. I'm listening to that on Audible. Give anything away, but highly recommend it to everybody.
It sounds fantastic.
Did you ever record any of your books?
No. I don't think any of them are audiobooks, actually. I mean, my own books, probably for audiobooks were quite such a big thing.
No.
So maybe it'd be fun to do them as audiobooks, I think. But all my main characters are male, so I could narrate the opposite of Amber. That's got a female main character, and I'm very fond of her as well. So,
I think you can do it there. The number of audible voice actors who are male who then have to do a great many female voices, I mean, including in the latest Strike novel. I think if you have the talent, it's doable. You go with it, don't you? Again, this is the thing about creativity. What's the phrase about
suspension?
If you're able to have suspension of disbelief,
yes,
then you are with that author, you are with that actor reading those lines.
Right. I mean, actually, I'm curious. Is it a male reading the Strike novel? Right.
Yes.
So what happens when he gets to female dialogue? Does he kind of does it sound kind of like a put on female voice, or is the inflection different? Or I'm really curious.
He lightens his voice, but he doesn't exaggerate to the point that certain males who may think they are females do lighten their voices. Yes.
Right. Yes, because, you know, it can be done that way. The other way, it's a parody. It's an absolute parody of a female.
Absolutely,
voice.
And it doesn't sound like parody. I think he does a good job. Other people might not. And there are lots of other voice actors out there, and the authors of books themselves who do their own audible recordings, who are superb,
right.
Both male and female. And I think it's a real skill to first be able to write something that can be read out loud. Because, of course, that's how we first did it, when we told each other stories.
Right.
But to be able to be carried along with a book that is a page-turner, that your books are, and then to be able to be carried along in that story and something, you know, in the oral tradition or listening to it on Audible, in the car, in the lorry, I think this is wonderful. And it's this sort of creativity and art that we need to cherish, and we need to inspire children and young adults to be able to give these things a go and have that freedom. And
yeah.
It's okay if when you first start out, it's not that good, because nobody is. and you have to be able to make mistakes.
Everybody's
and not
got
be cancelled for any of it.
Exactly. And I mean, people do make mistakes. As I say, proud as I am of the Rebel Angels, but there's a million things I would change about them now. But, you know, it's all a progress. It's development. It's you're learning the whole of your life. I mean, I truly believe that. And you know, you stop learning, you might as well give up. You know, we got to learn. But I've got a couple of credits on Audible. I must get the Strike book. The ones that I've really enjoyed. I'm trying to think who I listen to a lot of non-fiction at the moment, and the people I've really enjoyed reading their books aloud were Helen Joyce, doing Trans, Victoria Smith doing Hags,
and
John Sweeney, who I've been listening to his books on Putin, and also Galen Maxwell, and he kind of puts on voices as well, but they're actually quite well done and they're quite entertaining. So he's good.
I always listen to the little excerpt first, and if it's a book I really, really want to read, but I can't get to grips with a voice, it's a no-go.
Right. Yes.
I'm a real voices person. It's got to be the right voice.
Yeah, it's a lot of hours to spend with a voice that you just don't get on with. Yeah.
I have to say, though, a Scottish accent does help. It's beautiful. And I appreciate Scotland is a big country. There are lots of different accents, but I haven't met a Scottish accent I don't like.
Awesome.
So where you are at right now is you are waiting for your tribunal result. You are working, driving,
yep,
listening to your country music and your audible books, looking after lots of animals. Mm-hmm. And you have so many more followers and supporters than you had before all of this kicked off.
Oh, yeah.
Anything you would like to say about those women and men and the FSU who have supported you and will continue to support you through this?
It has been simply amazing. And I was taken aback by the support. I didn't actually expect the support that I got. It's the women and men on Twitter who are part of this fight. They just astonish me every day. I mean, I spend in the morning before I go to work, I spend about like half an hour, three quarters of an hour on Twitter because I'm addicted.
Yeah.
I sit there, retweet and I retweet and I retweet because it's the arguments from our side are so beautifully put. They're beautifully expressed. They're damn funny.
Yes.
And I just sit there in amazement, like retweeting just little bites of sharp wit and smart insight and thinking, I can't even write this myself. I'm just going to retweet it. Da, 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 da. I can't even comment. It's fabulous. And they're amazing. And as I say, they will get behind anyone like me who is hunted or mobbed or anything. Mm-hmm. And they are incredible. They rally around people in the most incredible way. And it's fabulous. As for the Free Speech Union, what would any of us have done without the Free Speech Union? I first called the Free Speech Union, well, I emailed them kind of in desperation. I didn't know if they'd take any notice. I emailed them on the 27th of June 2020, which was the day after I was fired. And they got back to me almost immediately. They, you know, said, can we call you? Toby Young called me and I had a long conversation with him. He said, we're going to help you. You know, this is this kind of thing can't be allowed to happen to people. We're going to help you. It was incredible. And may I just add that it never even that did occur to me to approach the Society of Authors, but I dismissed the idea almost instantly because I had seen how they had treated Rachel Rooney. When Rachel Rooney, who I'd mentioned before, the woman who was cancelled by other children's authors, she had been utterly dismissed by the Society of Authors. They had not taken her seriously at all. And in fact, in the last 24 hours, it is really worth looking at Rachel's Twitter feed. She's at Rooney Rach, that's R-A-C-H. She's published a letter that she's just sent to the Society of Authors, which details exactly what happened to her. How they treated her in the aftermath of the abuse she got, how they were sort of just a little clique among themselves trying to dismiss her. And it's also available on Loopy Lou's Substack, which is, you know, she's at Loopy Lou Dino on Twitter, and she's published this letter on her Substack. It's really worth looking at because it shows you kind of the contempt with which the Society of Authors treated anyone who wasn't actually on their ideological wavelength, even though they were members. So yeah, never occurred to me to, seriously, to reach out to the Society of Authors. I knew it was going to be a waste of time. I am so glad and so grateful that I reached out to the Free Speech Union because they were instantly of help. I mean, instantly they wanted to do something. I had someone on my side. They were making practical suggestions. And since my case and before it, they have helped so many people. Mm. And were it not for the Free Speech Union, authors with the wrong, in inverted commas, opinions would have nowhere to go because their own supposed union, the Society of Authors, isn't interested. It's not interested in ending these people. But the Free Speech Union is. And they're simply staggering. I mean, they found me really excellent legal team. They set up my crowdfunder. And by the way, if should my case fail and there's money left over from my crowd justice campaign, that will go to another free speech case.
Good.
That I think that's important to know. They are supporting so many people because this is happening so much and so often. It's happening far too much. They shouldn't have to be doing this.
No.
A Western liberal democracy, but they are, and they're doing a damn good job. I mean, they have won so many cases.
And yet we're told cancel culture doesn't exist.
Yeah, exactly. When they say cancel culture doesn't exist, they mean that person isn't dead speaking. You know, that's what they mean. And they, you know, some cases, I think they wish we were dead so that we couldn't speak. But the speech union has been amazing. And I would like, if I can, particular shout outs to Warren Cabral, who has been the most amazing legal advisor. He's put so much work and time into this. Basically, for no financial reward. He's doing it because he believes in it, and he's a Free Speech Union member, and he's simply been astonishing. And Bryn Harris, who is the legal guy at the FSU. But everyone at the FSU is amazing. You know, from the top to the bottom, they're a fantastic, fantastic organisation. And we really need them. You know, everyone in this country needs them, frankly, because they are the ones who are standing up for something that should be a basic tenet of our democracy.
Agreed. I am a member too, as well as WRN, of course.
When it's going to happen.
Yeah. What advice would you give to any women and men who are currently in publishing, whether as writers, authors, illustrators, editors, who do share your views but are possibly somewhat trapped?
This is actually a tough one to answer. Partly because I think it divides along the line of sex, as so much does. Sex matters. If you're a woman with responsibilities and you're scared, I completely understand. I completely understand that you cannot be public and give your name, because the point of cancelling people like me and Rachel Rooney, it's not solely or even mainly to destroy us. It's to intimidate others. And it's worked like that. And it has intimidated others. I mean, I know fine it has. I've had messages. And I completely understand that. It's terrifying. I would say it gets easier. The more people speak out, the easier it's going to get and the harder it's going to be to cancel people. There is that. But I also think there are some extremely successful male authors who could actually speak about this. Men do not get, with the exception of Graham Linehan, who has given so much to this cause and has lost so much. But with the exception of Graham Linehan, men do not tend to get it in the neck to the same degree. I think men who understand what nonsense this is should speak out more often.
Agreed.
A well-known author did speak out last week, and it was a beautiful moment. He'd been one of the ones who'd harassed Rachel Rooney, and he actually apologised to her. And that was a courageous and rather lovely act. But there's too many male authors who I think know fine what a crock of shit this is, but because they don't want the hassle. Well, you're not going to get the kind of hassle that women get, mate. You actually, you're well-known enough, you're successful enough, and you're indispensable enough to the industry that you actually could speak out. And I think you know you could. You just don't want the hassle. However, to the ones who actually still believe in this, there's those ones as well. And I think I would just like them to think. I'd just like them to use their empathy and imagination. You know, they're writers. they may be middle class and living in North London, some comfy place in Surrey or something. I don't know. They're never going to be in jail. They're probably never going to be in a women's refuge. Use that writerly empathy and imagination and try to understand why sex is important as a classification. Understand what it would be like to be a woman locked up with a 6-foot bloke with all his genitals still intact in the shower room in a prison or in a women's refuge. I know you're scared to think, because if you thought about this for more than 10 seconds, you would understand how wrong it is, how utterly based on sexist stereotypes, which was the first thing that grabbed me about this ideology. But you're scared to think because you know that you would realize it's rubbish, and you know that you had responsibility to speak out, and you're scared. So just think, just take a little time to think through it. The first thing that grabbed me about this entire ideology, I appreciate there are people with gender dysphoria, and it must be a terrible, distressing thing to have. For a start, most kids grow out of it, so leave kids alone. Stop medicalizing kids, blocking their perfectly natural puberty and setting them on a path towards surgery, unnecessary surgery and amputations. That for a start. But also, it's based on, what is it? They say that a man feels like a woman. What does that mean? It's entirely based on stereotypes. It's all about the damn accessories. It's what is it?
There's a certain look that they appear to go for as well.
Right. Mm. And it's always, yes, exactly. And it's so clearly based on sex stereotypes. I mean, I have short hair. And, you know, yeah, people are always saying it on Twitter, you know, if they're trying to have a go at me, they say, oh, she's a closet trans man. Yeah, no, mate.
Can't see what Julian just did there.
Yes. I just wiggled my boobs. So what is it based on? How do you know what it feels like to be a woman? Yeah, don't. Just as I can try to imagine myself into a male character and I can have real fun doing it, but I don't actually know. No. I don't actually know what it's like to be inside a young man's head trying to deal with the modern world. I can try to imagine, and I can try to think beyond stereotypes. That's another thing. But I don't know. And you don't know what it's like to be a woman. All that is based on stereotypes. So you like wearing pearls, you like wearing a skirt, you like having long hair, do it. You know, grow your hair long. You know, put it in barrettes. It looks great. My son's got long hair. It looks fabulous. I've got short hair. I much prefer having short hair. It's much easier.
Yeah, I'm with you on that one.
It's all damn stereotypes, the whole damn thing. You know, and you know, once you accept that and see that for what it is, the rest of it unravels pretty damn fast. So think, that's what I advise to people. Just A, if you've seen it, this already for what it is, you know, try and find your courage. But I understand if you haven't seen it for what it is, just think. Just, I don't know. Read Helen Joyce's book. You know, don't let people tell you it's hate speech. It's not. Just read a bit, think a bit. Honestly, you're too intelligent for this.
Well, what is it they say? It takes a very intelligent person to believe stupid things.
Well, that's, yeah, there's definitely an element of that. Yes.
Thank you ever so much for talking to us on the WRN podcast. Where can the listeners find you on social media, and where can they buy your books?
Oh my God. Well, on Twitter, I'm at @Gillian_Philip, and Philip only has one L, no S. My books, I've got a website, gillianphillip.com. Again, just the one L in Philip, Gillian with a G, .com. And there's a books page on that website. It's got all the books I authored. All the books I wrote and created and imagined myself. So, yeah, they're all there. There haven't been any new ones, but with any luck, they'll be some one day.
Okay. Dot dot dot.
My favorites. by the way. Crossing the Line is out of print, but I'm hoping to re-release that at some point.
Okay. If I
go down and adjust the file. My favourites are the Class of the Titans one for kids, Clickbait, Opposite of Amber, and Firebrand. That's just my favourites. I'm just saying.
Good to know.
Yeah.
Good to know. We will put all of the links of you and to your books and those that you've mentioned previously in the podcast notes so that listeners can go take a look.
Thank you so much. And thank you for having me on. Honestly, I said to a colleague just yesterday, do not get me started in this subject. You know, I'm like, what's that going? Don't get me started, Screeds. And same applies today. You do not get me started. I mean, I've been rabbiting for an hour and a half. Oh, but thank you so much for having me on. I've had such a blast. And it's been so lovely to talk to you.
I've had a blast too. Thank you. Thank you for tuning in to the Women's Rights Network podcast. You can find all about the WRN over at womensrights.network. And if you'd like to join us, womensrights.network/join-WRN.